So this episode, we are running on empty. Two of the three of us are completely out of action. My voice is knackered.
I'm knackered voicing.
Yeah. Mm. So we're going to hand the reins to our resident Scott. He's the keys, big boy. Off you go.
I'm full of beans. I can't wait. It's about time I got a word in edgeways from you two fuckers. Here's a fakesham.net podcast.
Oh, nicely done.
First you want to kill me, now you want to kiss me. Blow.
Hey, you've got 3 seconds for it.
I'm going to amp this baby up, see how it sounds.
I want you to add one more thing, something more almost from the bottom of your womanhood. To make it a...
Thanks for listening. My name's Glenn.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jared.
And we've got a big episode to get through here. It's Oscar time.
We love Oscar time.
Don't sound too enthusiastic about it.
I'm feeling good about this. About all of it.
I'm fucking pumped. So we're going to go through a whole lot of stuff. We're going to talk about the films that we think are going to win. And then we'll briefly mention the films that we'd like to win. They could be the same. Wait and see. But Sean's hosting this episode, so where would you like to start?
Why does this always get come down to me?
It doesn't. This is the first episode it ever has.
I know. We haven't even got to the Oscar movies, and it's firing up right 45 now.
45 seconds in.
This is going to be terrible.
Would you like to start with best film? Go with the big guns.
Yeah, I don't have the list, though.
Oh, well, I'll read it out
there. Okay, go.
All right, so the films nominated for best film are The Big Short, Brooklyn, Bridge of Spies, Mad Max Fury Road, The Martian, Room, Spotlight, and The Revenant. Too many fucking movies.
Stupid amount of films.
That is just ridiculous. Even to read, it's ridiculous.
It takes too long.
All right, so there's three of us. Let's go through. You go first.
I think the press junkets would have you believe that it's probably going to be The Revenant, I would say, for obvious reasons. You know, It's a film with substance, it's a film with class, it's one of those ones that come out every so often and you can peg them a mile away where they're just going to be critics' babies from the get-go. Revenant is absolutely a critics' baby. I think that's probably your 2-1, I'd say.
You reckon?
I reckon. I reckon The Revenant is a really... I think on a close behind that, my pick for best film would be Mad Max. But I don't necessarily think it's got the chops. I've seen The Revenant twice now.
Yeah.
And even on the second viewing, it's probably richer on a second viewing. Sure. I just don't know if Mad Max can stand up to that kind of repeat viewing. I don't think it has the depth that would necessarily class it as a best film. And I know I've changed my tune.
Sure.
I've changed my tune, but that's because I've seen The Revenant twice. Yeah. And it is staggering.
And it comes off the back of Birdman, so there's momentum
exactly.
Clearly there.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. It doesn't always work, though. Let's not forget The Hurt Locker and Catherine Bigelow. Like,
yeah.
One doesn't necessarily obviously guarantee the other, even if you are a critic's darling.
But they were years apart. This director's backed it up one year after another. So maybe.
That would be interesting.
Has that ever actually happened before?
Not back-to-back year after year. It's not with actors it has.
Yeah. Actors it has, yeah.
But not directors.
Films, I should say.
What about you?
Well, I've seen all the Academy Award nominated films bar one, Brooklyn, so I can't speak on behalf of that film, but I've seen the trailer and I'm very interested in seeing it. Personally, I feel The Big Short was the film I enjoyed the most.
Right.
Whether it deserves an Academy Award for Best Picture, probably not.
It's a really interesting film, one.
Yeah,
it is, isn't it?
It's played in layman's terms and it was really easy to, you know, understand something that I had no interest in prior.
Yeah.
And they made it engaging, they made it funny, and, you know, it was entertaining. But is it an Academy picture? Probably not.
It plays on the fact that it knows the audience has no idea what the fuck's going on.
Yeah.
So it breaks that fourth wall really cleverly.
Yeah, and that was the thing about The Big Short that surprised me was just how stylized it was.
Yeah.
The risks that it took for a film that is, you know, and I shudder to use the expression, like, sort of Oscar's checklist, I like to call them.
Yeah.
A film that has an Oscar's checklist. If we include this, we'll be. But it was kind of brave. It was a bit more brazen for a film of that caliber than I thought it would be.
I think that's partly due to the director, Adam McKay. Yep. Came from a background in comedy, was willing to sort of take risks. And the things that you saw in The Big Short weren't too uncommon to the comedies that he had made. Granted, you know, the comedies made like Talladega Nights and that, they are stupid and over the top.
Yeah.
But they are original in the way they present things. The narrative flow isn't, you know, classically structured, like, you know, Anchorman or anything like that. And so I think it was good bringing someone that's got a comic background into it. Like Jay Roach had directed Trumbo recently.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's interesting as well, seeing him cross over into sort of more heavy drama.
Yeah.
So I think it's good that we're seeing this fresh blood in what typically is, you know, something that's a little bit more a stalwart.
Yeah.
Scenario.
And what I said to Jared before, I found it interesting when they did break the fourth wall to break the story down to make it easier to consume.
Yeah.
They used actors that you wouldn't regard as intelligent.
Yeah.
You know, like,
Selena Gomez.
Selena Gomez and Margot Robbie and...
Yeah.
They've not, you know, you wouldn't consider them the, you know, most intelligent of people, but they've used them to sort of break it down for the layman in the audience. It's really clever.
Yeah.
I still didn't understand what the fuck was going on half the time.
Like, I had to explain some of it to Danny as we went through, because it is absolutely a film that sucks you in. He can get carried away with, you know, especially if you love film, you get carried away with the brilliant editing.
And the form, everything
that you kind of lose sight of the greater story. But I think it commands another viewing. But,
I agree. Yeah. But the thing you got to remember is that by the time the credits roll, which was a considerable amount of time later, what was it, 2.25 hours?
Yeah, it's pretty long.
By the time you're moved, like regardless of how lost you are in the terminology and all that kind of stuff, by the time it comes around, you're in shock and you're a little bit heartbroken and you've got that emotional connection. And the fact that he's managed to be able to bring it all the way around to, you know, outside of this borderline academia understanding of an exceptionally complex arena, he's still anchored in enough humanity that by the time the credits roll, you still feel shocked and dismayed with humanity. And I think that's a real skill. Like, that's really talent.
Due credit too, I think a lot of that humanity is carried solely by Steve Carell. Like, his character is the only one that really brings that, you know,
weight
and then really sort of presents it on a human level.
Yeah.
And amazing performance, I thought.
I agree.
And I will say the film that I believe is going to win will be The Revenant.
The Revenant,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm going double whammy because I think Mad Max will win and should win. So pretty much as simple as that. I just think it's a movie that's shaken up Hollywood in a big way this year.
I agree.
It would be incredible for a part four to win. I've said it before, but imagine that. Like, the first time that a part four sequel in a series has even gotten a nomination, let alone win.
Yeah.
I just think it broke enough ground for it to warrant the award, and I think that's what they'll go with. I think the fact that it stripped it back to practical in the rawest kind of way, but then did things that's never been done before.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see what he's going to do with the third chapter in the Babe franchise. What he can bring to that.
Well, you know, I hold high hopes because I love Pig in the City.
Yeah.
Such a good movie.
It was a grim installment.
Look, I hope it wins. I think it will really shake things up in Hollywood. I think genre filmmaking might have a little bit more credibility to it after this.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows?
There's a big, the big heart part of me is just like, I really hope Mad Max wins, but I don't believe.
No, that's fair enough. Well, time will tell. We'll, you know, by the time we have our next episode, we'll know who was right and who was wrong.
Probably by the time most people listen to this.
I was at the Film Critics Awards last week, and there wasn't a person in the room that did not want Mad Max to win.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mad Max took Best Film, I believe.
Oh, wow.
But The Dressmaker swept up most of the others.
You know, it doesn't surprise me.
No. And Jocelyn Moorhouse was there, so that was really cool.
Good.
Yeah. But anyway, sidetracked.
There you go.
So what film amongst those do you think doesn't belong? I would say.
Can you read them out to us again?
Yeah.
So there's too many to even remember, isn't there?
Well, you've got The Big Short, you've got Brooklyn, Bridge of Spies, Mad Max, The Martian, Room, Spotlight, and The Revenant. I'm going to say The Martian.
I'm going to say The Martian.
I'm going to say Room.
Wow.
Whoa.
That's huge. That's actually second on my list for films so far this year.
2016 so far. Wow. I'm going to say Room. Like, I mean, Martian's very close.
Did Room not completely bowl you over?
Not at all. No, wow. I thought Brie Larson did a great job in it. I don't think it was an exceptional job.
But the kid did a phenomenal job.
The kid was quite good, but I thought, I didn't think the film was anywhere near as emotional as I thought it was going to be. I think the trailer was incredible. Wow. But I actually spoke to, you know, the wife about it, because I sort of said, I don't know what it was about Room that I didn't really enjoy. And she said to me, I think it was the fact that it should have been more emotional. Like, I feel like we should have been moved.
That's amazing.
More. Yeah, wow.
And I don't know. I don't know where it sort of fell apart for me, but strange. I just didn't really
as my review
feel a connection to it.
As my review probably suggests, I walked out of that film shattered. Like, yeah. I felt completely emotionally spent.
Yeah.
And that one just struck a bell. Whereas The Martian, for me, it just feels comical and out of place. I know it's not a comedy, but it does feel light.
It's a popcorn movie. It's a good popcorn movie.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it's a popcorn movie. And,
yeah.
You know, yes, it should be nominated for a lot of technical awards. And yeah, maybe Matt Damon does deserve a nomination for Best Actor, maybe. But in terms of Best Picture...
You feel like it should be in the MTV Movie Awards or something.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like it has enough credit. And again, I'm going to sound like I'm backtracking on myself. It doesn't feel like an Oscars checklist film. It doesn't have all the things.
Mm.
It's kind of... It's just very... For lack of a better expression, it's very Ridley Scott.
Yeah. It's a token.
Yeah, it's...
And
is
the film nominated because it's a token sort of nomination because he's had such a great body of work that hasn't been awarded...
Well, maybe. That's disappointing if that's the case.
Yeah, I mean, that's politics. That's crowbarring politics in for the sake of it.
For the sake of diversity with the films nominated? Because there is a lot of heavy drama in there, with the exception of Mad Max. And it's the Academy voters. Who knows?
I don't think it's a bad film. I think it's a step in the right direction for Ridley Scott. Good. But it's nowhere near in the league of the rest of the films.
I agree. All right, so moving on, let's talk about the best actor in a lead role we'll go with. So you got Bryan Cranston with Trumbo, Matt Damon with Martian, Leonardo DiCaprio for Revenant, Michael Fassbender for Steve Jobs, and Eddie Redmayne for The Danish Girl.
Ooh.
I'll go first on this one. I think and wish it would be Leonardo. I just think it's a completely stellar performance. Physically, emotionally, it's just charged, it's electric.
I agree.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah, I think it's either going to be Leo. For those who say that it's Leo's time and he just deserves it, then that's horseshit. Because that's an argument that's just null and void. Because The Revenant is so good on just about every level. If he doesn't get it, close second has to be, in my books, Fassbender. For Steve Jobs.
Right.
I think a guy is just incredible. Yeah. That guy could read a phone book and I'd be happy with it.
For a second, I'm going to say Bryan Cranston for Trumbo. Because to see him play a role like this, like a lead, against having obviously played Walter White for six, seven years on television, this was a dramatic departure and really showed,
diversity
and ability. Like, that was, in my opinion, the best thing about Trumbo was the performance.
I'm heartbroken I didn't get to see it before. I won't get to see it before the Oscars.
Yeah, I'm the same,
Well, that's the shame too. It only opened theatrically on February 18th, so it hasn't even been here long enough for us to sort of catch up. And Brooklyn only opened a couple of weeks ago too, so it's been tough for us Aussies to catch up with these movies.
Yeah.
And I feel that, like, releases. Eddie Redmayne's nomination's that old, let's put prosthetics or wigs on people.
Have
and
you
all
seen
the...
it though? Oscar it checklist. Is an extraordinary performance. Like, no word of a lie. And particularly against, obviously, the theory of everything. You know, I hadn't seen Jupiter Ascending, which...
I have to admit, I don't like this
guy
at all.
I've heard his performance is awful. I thought he was exceptional in the film. I just didn't think the film was that great.
That happens
but
a lot.
But it seems
a lot,
topical.
Though,
it's topical because...
Yeah, obviously.
The subject matter is very topical, very, and I think that's why it's got a greater look in. But yeah, it's a very confronting film, and I thought he was really good in it too. To be honest,
he was
and the female
good,
lead, she was fantastic.
I just don't like it when these nominations come along and it feels tokenistic to me. So they put a wig on, or like Nicole Kidman in The Hours, put a nose on.
Well, what about Simple Jack? That deserves an Academy Award.
But isn't that even? I mean, like, even Kate Winslet.
He went all the way.
He went all the way.
Kate Winslet even makes reference to it in Extras. I think it's Kate Winslet. You're guaranteed an Oscar if you play a mental.
Yes, she is. Like, it's so good.
Right? You're guaranteed an Oscar
so
if you
good.
Play a mental.
Yeah, a
and
mental.
Yeah.
Right. Well, let's move on. And we'll talk about the best actress in the lead role. So you got Kate Blanchett in Carol, Brie Larson in Room, Jennifer Lawrence in Joy, Charlotte Rampling in 45 Years, and Saoirse Ronan in Brooklyn. And I
I gotta give him a little round of applause, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay,
give him a little round of applause.
Have a look,
because he managed to.
I spelt it phonetically.
that's very well.
I knew I wouldn't fucking get it right.
Yeah, well played. He pronounced her name correctly.
So, Jarrett, you go first in this one.
Okay, best actress Jennifer Lawrence. Plain and simple for me. Joy was a good film. not a great film, but a very good film.
I agree.
She was exceptional in it. I think she was what made the film, and this is the first thing I've seen her in where I went, wow, this girl's got a massive future ahead of her. Yeah. I've enjoyed her in the Hunger Games films. I liked her in Silver Linings Playbook. I think she was really good in that. But in this, she is absolutely incredible.
I agree.
Could not take my eyes off her. Like, she was just constantly engaging, and the way she carried that family, oh my God. I think it was an emotional roller coaster. You laughed with her, you cried with her, you felt everything.
Yeah.
And there was something really unconventional to the way that family dynamic was presented in the film. Like, it wasn't a simple narrative. Like, it was complicated. Everything was chaotic all the time. Just, and it showed what kind of stress she was under. And,
incredible.
And just a real dynamite of a performance. Absolutely. I'm going with her too. I think she'll win it, and she should win it.
I agree. And it's the first time I've watched her since Winter's Bone.
Right.
Because when I saw that I thought, when I watched Winter's Bone, knock sideways, right? It was one of those ones, never saw it coming. Yeah. I missed it in the cinema, saw it on DVD, watched it by myself one night, and when I went, I was at film school at the time, went in the next day, I was like, you have to see this film.
Yeah.
And I thought back then, so much promise. This girl was going to take over the world. She did take over the world, but she's never, in my opinion, capitalized on the promise she showed in Winter's Bone. Just appears in either largely nonsense or things that are below.
With the exception of Silver Linings, I think that was an incredible role. Well, but I agree, she's been doing X-Men and
but that kind of is the typical journey of a young actor in Hollywood.
Yeah,
it is.
Unless you're Leonardo DiCaprio. With, well, you know.
Yeah, in which case you get it taken away from you.
Exactly.
No, but you know, she jumped into the big machine movies, you know, the factory films, just because you make money, you know.
And then David O'Russell was like, I want to rescue her from the machine and this and that, but then I'll make American Hustle.
Yeah.
Oh, then I'll create my own machine of movies, like where the David Russell is a factory, you know.
Precisely. Bradley Cooper.
To be fair, Jennifer American Lawrence. Hustle was better than Silver Linings.
Probably. No.
No way. You've got to be joking.
I can't believe I'm
It looked like an episode of Bar-Jars.
Oh my
Come
God,
on.
It was ridiculous.
What do you mean it was ridiculous?
Silver Linings Playbook.
All it was costume design, production design. That was
badly done.
And badly, because it all looked fresh and new and shiny.
Not a chance.
And
number
really
96
sofa
fucking cop shop. Yeah.
Silver
Linings was moving.
No, it wasn't. Silver Linings Playbook
to
me.
It was an unconventional romance.
I'm going to punch you in the mouth in a minute.
I feel Glenn's with me though.
Silver Linings Playbook to me was taking an exceptionally delicate and big issue that is mental illness, and the film boiled down says, if you've got a mental illness and you're suffering tremendously, it's okay. Stop taking your meds, find somebody else who's also suffering, get them to stop taking their meds, join a dance troupe and everything will be fucking peachy.
Okay,
And then everybody comes back and says, oh, but you don't understand, Sean, because David O. Russell's son, he suffers from mental illness and he made the film for his son. But that doesn't make it a fucking good film. All it means is it's a horribly patronizing film to people who suffer from a horribly degenerative, sometimes degenerative, and other times destructive mental capacity. It is a horribly patronizing film that does nothing but damage people who have got and suffer from mental illness. Thank you for giving me the space, though.
I need to reply to
it's
that.
It's a film, too.
Let's I was about to say, it has no obligation whatsoever.
I will give you that.
It has no obligation whatsoever to represent anyone in any particular way. It's a fucking movie.
I will give you that.
Right? And David O. Russell did have a child, and he wrote the film from his own experience.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a personal film.
Well, I pity his child. Because if David O. Russell just takes his child along to a dance troupe and then lets him loose and says, everything's going to be fine, kid, that kid is in for a world of hurt.
Well, I'm glad the film ended where it did, and it seemed to end on a nice note.
I'm glad it ended.
Because who knows what happened afterward. Now you've got me worried they're going to be at each other's throats.
They'll be at each other's throat. They'll probably be like suicidal and all sorts of
things. There's a sequel in that.
So the actor in the supporting role, let's read these out. Christian Bale for The Big Short, Sylvester Stallone for Creed, Tom Hardy for Revenant, Mark Ruffalo for Spotlight, and Mark Rylance for Bridge of Spies. Sean, take it away.
I think who I want to win,
yep,
Sylvester Stallone.
Okay.
I think it's due time, and he was really good in Creed.
He was fantastic in Creed.
He was really, really good in Creed.
He represented a man suffering with cancer, like, you know, like
Was it a fair portrayal of somebody suffering from an illness that's terminal?
Yeah, I think it was. Certainly more so than Silver Linings. Certainly more so than Silver Linings fucking playbook.
But no, yeah, he went, he gave it his all.
Yeah.
And he wasn't afraid to look ugly. He wasn't afraid to be the support. He wasn't afraid to hand the reins over the film, the franchise, someone else.
I saw an interview this morning with his acting coach, and she said that...
Oh, yeah. What's her name?
Oh, fuck, I can't remember. Right. But he came to her with this film in mind, saying that, in a really humble way, I know I'm not a good actor, my days are numbered, I want to give this everything, and I don't know how to do it. And so he just spent all this time committed to learning how to deliver a performance like this, which, you know, for someone of his caliber doesn't have to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And he knows the character back to front, but he wanted to give it so much more dynamic and depth, and it's the best Rocky performance since the first one.
Oh, easily.
Yeah, absolutely.
Easily. Incredible. I quite like part six. I know that...
They're all fucking good.
I know that sounds horrible, but I think part six was particularly moving. I'm a sucker for all that father and son stuff. But this is his performance in Creed. Not only is the best since the first Rocky, the best thing he's probably done since the first Rocky.
Possibly. As far as Copland.
Copland. Yeah, Copland. Maybe. Yeah, not Copland. I give you that. Copland. But like, he has.
And what you said about part six is interesting, because I think that actually probably has more of a punch for me, like emotionally speaking.
Yeah, yeah.
But this one, his performance has more of a punch.
Completely.
The previous film, I think, has a bit more depth as far as his character's concerned. Yeah. With the sun stuff.
But at least we agree on that.
Yeah. I mean, because that's a film you could punch over. Like, it's fucking Rocky, you know?
Yeah, that's it.
What about you? What do you think? Excuse me, Jared.
Oh, no, I was... I'm for Sylvester Stallone. I want him to win, and I don't even want to think about the possibility of him not winning.
I know, it's kind of really heartbreaking.
And I almost just feel like, because he came out and sort of had said he'd asked the director if it would be okay to go to the Academy Awards because of all this sort of race debate and...
What's going on?
And I'm like, oh, why even go public and say these sort of things? Don't do anything that's going to draw any negative attention to you.
Yeah.
Just be, you know, just be the dark horse that
That draws
the Italian attention. Stallion.
The Italian
Stallion.
But that does draw positive attention because people see him as a sympathiser.
Yeah. And he's a level head.
It seems a bit hackish.
It does.
You know?
It does. Yeah. It becomes a gimmick.
Yeah.
Well, I think, I hope and I think that Mark Rylance will win for Bridge of Spies. I thought his performance was just amazing.
Yeah, that was a really good performance.
It was a performance that came from nowhere. Like, no one really knew who this guy was, despite his face being in so many films.
He's so familiar, but I couldn't tell you another film he was
in. But I thought his performance was chilling. Like, he was so... You didn't know the legitimacy of his character. Was he real? Was he not?
Absolutely.
Innocent, guilty. And he just held this stoic performance all the way through.
Good for him.
He is, in my opinion, the highlight of that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was an exceptional
performance. And he's obviously... He resonated with Spielberg because he's now the lead in the BFG. He plays the BFG. Yeah, so... It's good. It's like, you know, it's like Christoph Waltz. You know, this actor that's come along and had this massive resurgence. Thanks to one role and one director. So that's who my vote goes to. I hope he wins. Christian Bale, I don't think...
I thought he was great in
the movie. I thought he was really good in The Big Short. But yeah, he would be my... If I had to pick one that I think will win, is probably Christian Bale. One that want to win is probably Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah. It's hard too with a film like The Big Short where there's so many supporting roles.
True.
You know, it's hard to pick and choose.
Yeah.
But anyway, moving on to supporting actress... Jennifer Jason Leigh for Hateful Eight. Alicia Vikander for I think I pronounced that right. Hang on. Alicia Vikander for The Danish Girl. Mara Rooney for Carol. Kate Winslet for Steve Jobs. And Rachel McAdams for Spotlight. I'll go first. I reckon Kate Winslet. And I hope she wins.
I've got a double whammy on her. I think she'll win and I hope she wins.
I didn't like the film Steve Jobs, but I thought she was great.
She was general,
really good.
Here's how stupid I feel. I saw it the other day and I went with... my girlfriend Mary, and I leaned over to her half an hour into the film and goes, "That's Kate Winslet."
I did the same thing.
And then Mary turns around and goes, "It's always been Kate Winslet."
I did the same thing.
No prosthetics, no bullshit, no. It was actually just, I couldn't, 30 minutes into the film, I was like, "Holy shit, that's Kate Winslet."
Mm-hmm.
I just couldn't recognize her.
I'm with
if
you,
that isn't reason enough to win, then I don't know what is. I think she was phenomenal.
I learnt the other day that Danny Boyle flew all the way to Melbourne to visit her on the set of The Dressmaker to invite her to star in the film.
Wow.
That's probably how he got his hands on Sarah Snook.
Yeah, because she's in The Dressmaker.
Because she's in The Dressmaker as well.
Absolutely.
Awesome.
The Melbourne connection.
There you go.
But I thought she was phenomenal. And like, in The Dressmaker too, so she got these back-to-back performances that are really quite awesome.
Yeah, and did you hear about the little thing that happened between Leo and Kate at the BAFTAs?
Oscars? No.
Well, because Kate got the BAFTA for Best Supporting Actress, and Leo got the BAFTA for Best Actor, and her award came after his. And if he walked past her table, he gave her a nice little wink,
nice.
A little throwback to Titanic days, I assume.
She's on the record of saying that he's her best friend and always has been since Titanic.
Really?
Yeah. Okay, she's got, and they made Revolution Road together.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They've got a very strong friendship, apparently. Yep. So
forgot about that film. That was pretty hard going, very full on movie. Michael Shannon.
Was in it,
and of course, everybody knows that there was enough room for two fucking people on that raft, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
MythBusters went and explored it, and they proved it to be true.
Okay. So next up, we've got.
Oh, by the way, Kate Winslet for the win.
No! Oh,
because nobody cares what Jared's got to say.
There was a consensus within the conversation.
There you go.
Shall we move on to cinematography?
Yes. I think cinematography is going to be a real quick topic, though, because... Let's just do it formally, but we all know the answer. Okay.
That doesn't sound like...
Well, no, we don't.
Your setup made me think.
This is going to be horrible.
Okay, so we've got Ed Lachman for Carol, Emmanuel Lubezki for The Revenant, Robert Richardson for Hateful Eight, Roger Deakins for Sicario, and we've got John Seale for Mad Max. Who wants to go first?
Me, I think.
Have we got 10 minutes?
Yeah, have we got 10 minutes to listen to my angry tirade? No. I think if there's any justice in the world, it's going to go to The Revenant.
Okay.
I think if there's another close contender, it's going to be Deakins.
Mm. Okay.
I think it's going to be...
What's Roger Deakins nominated for?
Sicario.
Yeah, God, he's an incredible cinematographer. He is. He shot The Man Who Wasn't There, and you think how different a film that is to Sicario. The guy is just...
We've had this discussion before.
Yeah, we've talked about this. Firestorm. Oh, no, that was Dean Semler.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
My bad.
I'm sure we've had a Roger Deakins
conversation.
I'm sure we have, yeah. Mm. Yeah, no, I mean,
so is that your vote too?
No, I'm going with The Revenant.
Okay.
Yeah, I think if there's any justice in the world, it'll be The Revenant. Yeah.
All right, well, I'm going to go for John Seale. I'm going to mix it up.
Ooh.
I think Mad Max, just because I think he got his camera to do things with the stunts. Like, it was a real symphony of movement with everything combined.
Yeah, I agree with that.
You know, acting, stunts, camera, I think it was brilliant.
Yeah.
And coincidentally, he picked up the award for Best Cinematography, I believe, at the awards as well, the Critic Awards.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Mad Max cleaned up there.
Let's move on to, one of my favourites, Best Director.
Ooh.
All right, so George Miller for Mad Max, Lenny Abrahamson for The Room, Adam McKay for Big Short, Tom McCarthy for Spotlight, and can you pronounce Revenant's director for me?
Alejandro Iñárritu.
What's the middle name?
Gonzalez. Alejandro Gonzalez Iñárritu.
There we go. So who's going to take the bacon?
It's going to be Iñárritu or Miller.
But who's going to take the bacon?
No, you got to choose one or the other.
I think it's going to be.
That's not how the Academy works. They don't sit at the table going, "Oh, it's going to be either him."
It's
going to
be.
It's never a split.
It's going to be one of them, or it'll be the other one. I think it's probably going to be Iñárritu, but I hope it's going to be Miller.
My money's on Miller.
I think
all of the ones I've done, you notice, I'm going for favorite and what I think will win. I just reckon he's going to take it.
I really hope it does.
Yeah. Jared.
Alejandro.
It's just, I mean, the thing that those two films share in common, particularly of the rest of them, is just such a clarity of vision.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's obvious that these guys, it's not just a paid gig for them. They're not just a director for hire. They've got everything they've got invested in the film. And at any given stage in the 2 hour plus runtime of both those films, you're never, ever anywhere other than where those directors want you to be.
And the stark difference between the two, I think Mad Max is a complex film and it looks complex, whereas Revenant is complex cinematography that looks simple.
Yes,
absolutely.
He makes it look effortless, when in reality...
Everything's gliding and moving with the film.
In reality, I was watching it, I'm just like, we're all film students, and I was watching it thinking, I wouldn't even know where to fucking start.
It's like, how did he get the mountains to move around the camera? That's how it felt. It's like he's ice skating the whole time.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Especially that opening sequence.
Oh my God.
That, to me, kicked ass over anything he did in Birdman. Like, that opening sequence was just phenomenal.
That was a mind.
If only people could see my hand movements right now. Yeah.
His mind was blowing. Absolutely. It was just moving so seamlessly through everything and turning. And at a point, I felt like I was going to get motion sickness because it just didn't seem to stop.
Yeah.
And the choreography, everything that was happening in front of the frames. Just. And the madness of it all, like friendly fire, you know, all these things that you witnessing.
Yeah, you don't associate with a sequence of those kind of nature. Yeah. It's always very clean cut and they're the good guys and they're the bad guys and that's the end of it. Where this was just, it was horribly scrappy. It was coming from every direction. It was like, I agree.
You were in the thick of it. Whereas typically when you've watched these films in the past, like Jeremiah Johnson or something like that, it's a large scope. You know, it's Redford, large scope, big, you know, it's big landscapes and things moving. And
big sky.
It feels like you're watching it from a, you know.
Yeah. I had two problems with The Revenant. My first one was the horse going over the cliff.
Yeah.
That to me was like jumping the shark. It kind of took me out of the plausibility of this.
I thought it was
yeah.
No, it was pretty emotional.
For me it was like, it was just a bit extravagant.
Oh wow.
But I was torn apart. I'm like,
I was really bent out of shape because I didn't see it coming. And when it happened,
I did because I was in the trailer.
Well, yeah, I mean, but like, even when you see it in the trailer, I remember thinking, I would be so scared that I wouldn't be thinking that far ahead as well.
Yeah.
It would probably happen to me.
Fair enough. And the other problem I have with it is the title, because there's a great zombie movie called The Revenant, which I think should own that title.
I know the one you're talking about.
It's great.
I haven't seen it.
It's about the war vet that comes back.
Got like Dead Heat type of vibe.
Yeah. Anyway. So that wraps up our Oscar discussion. There is no better film to move on to than the Focus film we've got coming up.
True. I will just mention the nomination for Best Animated Film.
All right.
Should be Anomalisa. It's not going to win. It's going to be Inside Out, but it should fucking win.
No. Well, I mean, I haven't seen this, so I can't share your jubilation.
2 years in the making, stop motion. It's a lost art. Okay. It's so beautiful.
I'll go with close to 4 years in the making, stop motion, fucking Shaun the Sheep.
I'm going to go with Inside Out.
All right, well, my first instinct says it reminds me of my family. I hate my family.
So our focus film is Christopher Guest's 2006 For Your Consideration. A little bit about the film, gents. It's three actors that learn their respective performances in the film Home for Burum, a drama set in the mid-1940s American South, are generating award season buzz. So quite topical, obviously, on the eve of the Academy Awards.
And of course, it's a Christopher Guest film, so it comes off the back of other classics such as Waiting for Guffman, Best in Show, Mighty Wind. What have we got?
Big Picture.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's what we've got.
And of course, we can go backwards to Spinal Tap being the foundation for this style of film. This one breaks the mockumentary mold, but kind of has a mockumentary feel.
True.
Like, it feels like a bird's eye view kind of thing. Co-written with Eugene Levy, who has co-written most of them, I believe. Let's talk about the film. I think it's fucking great. I love it.
This is the third time I've seen it. Watching it the third time, the best time I've seen it. I think this film has gotten better over time.
Kind of helps to have people to laugh with, doesn't it?
I agree.
And the jokes, I think we all picked up on new stuff in there.
Absolutely.
Particularly with Fred.
Fred Willard's stuff. He is the show stealer for me. Like, his gags, as stupid and obvious as they are just brilliantly timed.
But he's hilarious. A master improviser. Like,
that's the thing. They all are. They're all incredible.
The thing is, this film doesn't have that mockumentary structure. It feels like a scripted film, but it's mostly improvised. And that's incredible. It just works so well. I would love to see what other footage they've got of other takes of other things they've, used. Like Fred Willard.
Yeah, the B-roll would be amazing.
100 scenes of his stuff,
But that's generally how Christopher Guest does these things. Like, writes the script, but then they do throw it to a lot of improv. And obviously it's harder when you're doing sort of a real sort of narrative structure as opposed to that mockumentary.
Yeah.
It's really putting everyone on the spot. And you can see some people, swim.
They embrace it.
Some kind of sink a little. Like, Gervais is a little fish out of water in this, I feel.
Yeah.
He's the weaker element. Like, it's got one or two great lines in it, but on the whole, it doesn't work for him.
Gervais feels like his stuff is traditionally scripted.
Yeah.
It feels like he's written it himself.
Yeah.
Like, he's been given the improv role, but he's gone and written it ahead of time.
Yeah.
Rather than thought about it in his head and then just sort of fucking launched it. Because they all sort of attack each other with these spontaneous pieces of improv and they react to each other, which we keep coming to Fred Willard, like, he's the pro.
Absolutely.
Because you watch season their veteran. Reactions of him. It's the same reactions we had, but they've got to suppress it. It's just
but
hilarious.
Him and, is it Jennifer Lynch?
Yes, Jane Lynch.
Yeah. Those two together, as on screen, they just got that chemistry. They feed off one another, it's brilliant.
I think it's probably worthwhile considering as well that the film only runs for 77 minutes.
Mm.
And given that improvisational formula that he's running with, that to me speaks volumes of the kind of director that he obviously is. He must have such a clarity of vision that he just can rein everything in and not let it run out. Because in these kind of films, you take and this is 40. This is 40 is like at least 40 minutes too long. And that's because he was
it's
doing
a great
the exact
film,
same.
But
it's
again,
good film.
It's too long.
Yeah, it's too long. But like the fact that he can get this film, get it so poignant as well, and then keep it under 80 minutes using that structure and that form, that is sensational.
And you followed a film from production through to release through to award season and you've
and beyond.
Absolutely.
It's loaded with content. Like there isn't any dead air in there at all.
No.
Like the comedy is just thick and fast.
That's the beauty. You've got that balance of comedy and you've got real drama. Like Catherine O'Hara's character, you really fucking feel for her. You know, she
dying
gets
these
Oscar buzz and she's feeding off that. She's a washed up actress, sort of living off former glories and playing things down, and you just suffer with her right until the very end. She's fantastic and funny, but at the same time quite tragic.
Yeah. And even below that sort of surface stuff as well, it is a really clever slight on Hollywood.
Absolutely.
And the Hollywood machine and what it is to be a part of the cogs of that horrible system. And it's delicate in its handling of it, but in that delicacy is where that devastation comes because it is so well nuanced and well observed.
It's a much heightened satirical version of like The Player or something like that.
I was going to say the very same thing.
And did you know, I only learnt the other day there's a sequel to The Player in book form. Like the novel has a sequel.
No, I didn't realize.
Return of the Player.
Really?
Oh my god. I mean, you know, Altman, you know, it's obviously, you know, Shamey's passed and he can't do it, but
anyone
should do that.
Yeah.
I'd want to see that.
I want to see P.T. Anderson do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel that would be interesting. Yeah, for him to do it.
We can have that. Hey, that's a good episode. We should have films that should be made and the filmmakers that should make them.
Yeah. Next
that'd
time.
Be a good
we couldn't
subject.
Get P.T. Anderson. We got P.W.S. Anderson.
Yeah. Paul W.S. Anderson.
Yeah, we got Paul.
The most successful British director of all time.
Yeah, he is. Just.
Also, so, what else do you want to add to this? I mean, what I found fascinating too is you've got people like Eugene Levy, Michael McKean, practically taking a back seat in this film.
Yeah.
You know,
mm.
Eugene wrote the film,
yeah.
and in all the previous ones, he's had a very prominent role, same with Michael McKean.
Mm.
But in this, they've kind of taken a back seat and let other people sort of channel it.
Yeah.
And the comedy comes from other people.
Because
they're not particularly funny. Eugene has some moments, but Michael McKean, not.
He's very straight.
He's dry,
absolutely. Absolutely.
This is the first time I've seen it. I actually haven't seen it until now.
Yeah.
It's really good. Mm. But I don't think it's as good as Best in Show.
No.
It's by far not the best. Like, I think, to me, A Mighty Wind's the best. I was telling Jared before
waiting
this
episode. Waiting for Guffman
for me. There you go.
There you go. All three of us.
Yeah. For me, Mighty Wind is a perfect film. I can't fault it in any way.
Yeah.
Both improv, story, music's amazing.
Music is fantastic.
Yeah. And there's a little throwback to that in For Your Consideration at the dinner table scene when they're doing that song. You feel like that's a song that's been omitted from that film?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Parker Posey.
Oh, Parker Posey.
I think, this is going to get me in trouble, but I think Parker Posey is my ideal woman. But she to me, whenever she shows up in any one of these films, she steals the show. Whenever she's on screen, she just makes it look so easy.
She's great.
She just has this natural affability where you just want to watch her, and everything she does, you just can't take your eyes off her, and she's hilarious. I think she's the best thing in the film.
Did you see her in Woody Allen's new film?
No, I didn't. Not yet.
Oh, she's great.
Is she?
She is fantastic.
Oh, she's the best thing ever.
Yeah.
I'm gushing.
Tell us about Acme and
Arkansas. Well, Acme here in Melbourne are doing a retrospective of her career. So they're showing a bunch of her films. You can see the Hal Hartley trilogy, the Henry Fool trilogy play. I did mention to Glenn, sadly, they've admitted Josie and the Pussycats.
Good.
Which is a shame. No, that's an exceptional role.
I would pay to see that on the big screen.
So much
goodness
in that movie. Rachel Lee Cook.
Yeah.
Anyway, we shouldn't be talking
about
this.
No, but it's a really... odd retrospective kind of
exhibition. It's an interesting choice. Yeah.
They've got a brand new director there at Acme, right. And it's sort of bringing something new to the game. And
just a shame they didn't bring her down for just a, you know, in conversation with Parker Posey.
That would be interesting because she's pretty dynamic. I mean, outside of her comedy stuff. Anyway, we digress.
I want to talk quickly about Catherine O'Hara. I think she's so amazing.
Oh my god!
I don't think she knows how to act poorly. Like, she's just,
yeah, it's just not.
Well, she can act poorly deliberately, but she's just phenomenal. And the way they made her face look botoxed in this,
I can't tell if that was.
I don't know how they did that.
From memory, I don't even think it was real Botox. I remember Jennifer Coolidge in Mighty Wind offered to do Botox, and they said you don't have to take it to that extreme.
Right.
But in this one, I think it was natural, and they just used tricks of like moisturizers and facial expressions and holding muscles.
Yeah, that was incredible.
You can see her really holding the muscles.
Oh yeah.
You know, and she's repulsive in those scenes where she looks Botox. Mm. Hideous.
Yeah. And there's a monologue at the end that, you know, she performs where she's, it's all about being comfortable in your own skin. And yeah. It's just the most awful thing to hear as you're looking at this
monster.
Yes, this deformed woman.
And to think the energy to hold that face, because if it wasn't done prosthetically or whatever, the energy to hold it and then deliver that.
Yeah. For weeks at a time as well.
Even the moments before that, she had like a scene where she was drunk in the driveway, throwing like a
genius.
Tent. Like, it was amazing. It's like a real amazing performance.
And the scene with Parker Posey and her, where it's almost like you feel Parker Posey has this moment where she sees her and almost sees that could be her in another 30, 40 years' time. And that's why she almost moves back to her roots of, you know, not comedy theater. I think it was more performance art that she was doing in very strange performance art, very entertaining performance art.
I took it as an indictment of look what the system has done to you. Like it's so damaging. That it actually changes the way you look and the way the world sees you by being a part of this machine.
But at the same time, like it has that indictment stuff, but also they did it to themselves. They bought into the hype.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they really sort of, they represented those actors so full of themselves that they consider themselves a shoo-in long before anyone else
does. And before the film's even finished.
Yeah, that's right.
Before it's even been seen by anyone. It's just hype. But the interesting question I think this film raises is how hard would it be if you are, you know, a key player in Hollywood, be it, you know, acting, directing, and this Oscar buzz is around the place. And, you know, I know there's people that don't watch their own films or they try and avoid reading articles, but there's only a certain amount of that you get. That you're going to have friends and even, you know, not necessarily colleagues from within the industry, but just friends of family and that. Yeah. They'd be like, oh, you know, you've got a good chance this year. And there'd be no way to avoid it. It'd be this constant build-up. I can't imagine. Poor old Leonardo DiCaprio.
No. Oh, my God. It's 10 years of that nonsense. Oh,
but the other thing, there are so many players in Hollywood, big Hollywood players, that seem very genuine and sincere. I would say Leonardo DiCaprio to some extent, George Clooney another one, like where you see them and they look very, very natural and down to earth. But there's so many of these kind of films that really, really lampoon them in a way that you think, I'm not so convinced that they are genuine, you know? Yeah. Like, there's got to be so much ego at
play. There has to be, something else happening because you want to make it look like, this is cynical, but you want to you want to make it look like you're just like us. But you aren't just like us.
True.
You can't be just like us.
And the really good actors will make us believe they are.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
you know, like you only have to see in the actor's studio or, you know, any of those.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, they're just like us.
Yeah.
And this week,
they both put their
Scarlett Johansson released a photo of herself without makeup.
Yeah.
Big article saying she's just the girl next door, she's one of us. It's like, well,
no, she's not.
No, she's not at all.
Jennifer Lawrence isn't just like us.
No.
Like they're not. they want to be, which is
an
interesting topic in itself. Like they have everything we want, but anyway, we digress again.
So anything else you want to add to it? I think we should just do a quick mention to Harry Shearer. He's great.
He's so good.
Yeah, he's good in anything. Michael Higgins, I think he's good.
Oh, he's great.
Yeah. That guy has a voice everything that comes like in. Silk.
Oh, him in Pitch Perfect doesn't get much funnier.
So
And
I'm excited by the fact that I read when I looked this film up on IMDb that Christopher Guest's new film is in, I think it's in post-production.
Oh, wow.
Mascots. Oh. And it's about rivaling team mascots.
Good.
And it's going to be mockumentary.
I feel it's going to be another mockumentary and all the key players are back again. So
that's fantastic.
I'm excited.
Bring it on.
It's been too long between films.
It sure has.
You know what they say about blind prostitutes? You really have to hand it to them. We can cut that out. I don't know why I got that.
No better time to talk about guilty pleasures It's been a while since we've done a guilty pleasure.
It's been a long time. I think the last one was like October, November last year. It feels like a really
can't
long
even
time.
Remember my I last guilty pleasure.
Yeah, I can't even remember my last one.
Wow. All right. I'll go first.
Okay.
I watched this one recently, and I'll tell you what. I always knew it was bad, but I watched it recently, and I realized it's nowhere near as bad as what I thought it was. In fact, I think it's fucking good. And it's Mr. Accident, Yahoo Serious' third film.
Right.
The year 2000. I think it's better than Reckless Kelly. I think it's so far underrated that it's not funny.
Better than Reckless Kelly.
Absolutely. And it plays better now than it did back then. I think there's so much really, really good comedy that sort of got lost in translation when it first came out because people just knew Yahoo Serious as the guy with big hair.
Yeah, yeah.
But as
that's
far as,
all I know him as.
As far as physical slapstick comedy, I think it's right up there with, you know, almost with Young Einstein.
Wow.
Young Einstein's phenomenal.
It is a
we
classic.
We covered that film
it's
already.
A classic.
But Mr. Accident, I think even back then when we covered Young Einstein, I talked about Mr. Accident as being that, you know, that shitty kind of film.
Was it? Bit of distance between Reckless Kelly and Mr. Accident,
about
though,
10 years.
Oh, yeah, I thought it was about 8 years, yeah.
Maybe
his,
even more.
His star had sort of fallen by that stage, and he did it pretty independently.
Yeah.
And
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And look, it's a really, really dumb story. It's right. It's a dumb story about an accident-prone maintenance man and his UFO-obsessed girlfriend who discover an evil plan by a corporate boss to lace the egg supply with nicotine to get everybody addicted to eggs.
Yeah.
And it's just dumb. Some really bad gags, for example. The opera house has been turned into the factory for the eggs, so therefore the shell shape has been turned into egg shape.
Right.
That's dumb. But sight gags. And what must have gone into the production to achieve the sight gags? You know, we're talking full car smashes over cliffs, you know, stunt work like you can't believe. Really, really good studio work with, there's a scene at the start where his apartment floods. It's a comedy of errors, like a throwback to the silent movies. Really, really cleverly choreographed. And I will add that actress Helen Dellymore, about as sexy as a woman can ever get on film.
He always has very attractive women.
She is.
I don't think that's an accident.
In these movies.
I've always had a raging heart on for this woman.
Right.
She played like Glinda in the original Wicked musical.
Okay.
And I didn't realize it was her in this film until I watched it recently.
Last
week.
Shivery timbers.
Is this film available? It's pretty hard to come by.
It's on Netflix or one of the streaming services, but not physically.
No
physical.
Yeah.
I've got an American one.
Yeah.
Isn't that bizarre?
Yeah, it's, but I would highly recommend going back and watching it.
Yeah, I will.
With a fresh open mind. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he's good. He's really good.
Right.
Yeah, anyway.
Good figure.
There's my guilty pleasure. And I'm not even guilty now, having watched it recently.
Yeah, fair enough.
Fun.
There you go.
I feel pretty guilty about mine, to be honest.
Here we go.
Initially, I was going to go with Ruggero Deodato's 1986 film Body Count, which is a slasher film from the mid-80s, and in a sort of form of Friday the 13th. It's bad, but it's really enjoyable. But then I saw a film this week, and I think about seven of us came out of the movie. Wife and I had a ball. Everyone else thought I was mad. They said it was rubbish. They said
at the movies.
I know.
Yes.
It's
just
open
to the movies.
It's Point Break, isn't it?
No. I'm not going to say it. It's Proyas's new film.
It's Alex Proyas's new film, Gods of Egypt.
No.
Yes.
This has piqued my interest.
Now, okay, so I'm going to give you a small synopsis. Very small.
Go
it's
for
brother
it.
Versus brother, who both happen to be gods. And they're competing for the coveted spot of King of Ancient Egypt and for the fate of all Egyptian civilization.
Is that an award they give out regularly? King of all Egyptian gods?
Every year.
Yeah, every year. It just happens that this year.
It's
a remake
spot.
Of Warrior,
it's
but just with ancient
spot.
Gods.
It's two brothers. Okay, so you've got Jared Butler as one of them. So
this is Egypt!
Good.
And you've got Jamie Lannister is the other. You might know Jamie Lannister from Game of Thrones.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay.
That chiseled Fabio-looking dude.
Ellie Young, who's in Daredevil, I think. Yep. In Netflix, Daredevil plays Elektra.
She is, she is waif thin.
Yeah.
Horribly thin.
Thought that was just the CGI.
Yeah.
But she
is dementedly
looks like
thin.
She eats like a you know, leaf of lettuce.
Yeah, it looks like she's on the Gwyneth Paltrow diet.
Yeah.
You can make a soup by
Rufus
adding some
Sewell
beans to water.
Oh, yeah.
You know, who we'd worked with Brian on Dark City. Yeah.
Sure.
A heap of Australian talent, because it was actually shot here in Sydney. You've got Brendan Thwaites, who's in Son of a Gun and was in The Giver. Jeffrey Rush, and he is exceptional in this film because he is so hammy, and he's pretty much three quarters of his screen time he's on fire. He's Sun Ra, the sun god, and he is incredible.
He's literally on fire. So
great. Yeah, he's actually on fire.
It's hilarious because everyone's doing an English, you know, accent to a degree, except Jeffrey Rush. He does Jeffrey Rush. But
Gerard Butler, who's Scottish.
I don't even know what he's trying to do, but the beauty of it is no one can keep an accent throughout it. They keep slipping, and it's almost like they don't care, and no one really, no continuity person was going, maybe we need to go back because that doesn't sort of match the voice.
Man.
It didn't seem like maybe they could have gone back and fixed things in ADR. I don't know. Apparently, they spent $140 million on the movie. And it doesn't look like it because the CGI looks like it was all rendered maybe 5-7 years ago. but so, you know, it's generally on par with the Clash of the Titans, you know, Wrath of the Titan films in terms of
the CGI. I struggle with those type of films.
Absolutely, and I was worried it would be the case with this movie, but no, it is just balls out silly. Like, it is funny, and it seems to, it doesn't, it's not like it's tongue-in-cheek, it just knows that it's dumb, so it may as well be fun. And it runs for 127 minutes, did not know. On IMDb, it was listed as 100 minutes the night I saw it. The next day, they re-listed it at 127. I said to Danny, geez, that was a fast 100 minutes. And she said, no, it was like at least 2 hours. And I looked at it as 127
You know,
minutes.
I reckon you should write a review for this one because I don't almost, know if I can be bothered.
I'd almost do it. It's 300 meets Transformers meets Flash Gordon, in my opinion.
Nice.
70s Flash Gordon. What else want to mention? Oh, okay, because of course the gods are much larger than anybody else. They use a lot of force perspective and it's awful. So they've got like stunt doubles, like so midget stunt doubles, and a lot of CGI. Oh my god.
I read today our fellow Melbourne podcaster, Mr. Wayne Pollock, described it as a throwback to the Ray Harryhausen style.
And
films.
Absolutely, and that's what I've said too. It feels like it's like Jason the Argonaut, all the Clash
and you know, I will give a nod of kudos to Wayne because he quite often nails those descriptions like that.
Yeah.
And
it's very much a throwback to that, except in place of the stop motion, we've just got dated CGI, which kind of feels like old stop motion.
It's the modern stop motion.
Yeah, absolutely. Dated CGI. It feels like one of those, you know, Asylum type films, except if they had a lot of money, but they worked off generally the same script and they had a B-list cast to work with.
But let's talk about Alex Proyas. How far they fall. Like,
well, that's what I was going to say is the reason I have absolutely no faith in this, not only because Gerard Butler is, he's old news now. Like, how is he keeping relevant? Like, London has fallen. Like, Olympus has fallen. It was terrible.
And they're opening a week apart from one another in the US.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Even locally, I think.
Quickly interrupt you there, because I saw a bus this morning with the London has fallen banner on the side of it.
Yeah.
It looks like the poster for Britain's Got Talent.
Yeah, it looks horrible. Right.
Terrible.
Anyway. So that's the first thing. Second thing is Proyas. When was the last time Proyas actually made a good film? And it was before Garage Days. And that was in 2002.
I'm gonna defend Knowing because I love Knowing.
Well, see, I don't like Knowing, but I will defend iRobot. I think iRobot was.
I hated iRobot.
It's sitting on 7.1 on IMDb though. iRobot should not be 7.1. How does that work?
I don't know.
But it's a 6.1. But I liked iRobot.
All the same, iRobot, Knowing, they're not the same caliber of film that he was doing. Back with
no,
the Crow,
and that's
with
where
the
I will
Crow
go
and Dark
say,
City.
I will say The Crow, but I remember seeing Dark City on an advanced screening and I didn't dig it. Went back and watched it probably about a decade ago and thought, no, I'm
still
coming
works
back
for me.
It's great.
Did not enjoy it.
I really dig it.
Did
but that was the
what do you think of the director's cut?
That's what I watched. Maybe it was a little less than 10 years ago, but that's what I watched, the director's cut. And I was thinking maybe I'm missing something, but I came back and I said, no, it just feels a bit hammy.
Okay.
You know.
But yeah, and it kind of is.
But he's never,
it's a noir
in my opinion, never been this visionary director that a lot of people say he is. But I think he's done a great job with what this is. Like, it's a shit script to begin with.
Do you think that it started out the way it turned out? Do you think they had different ambitions for it?
I think so. It feels like maybe they put too much money in and at one point they ran out. And they had to stop. We're going to have to get rid of some of the animators. We're moving the animation over to India. We're outsourcing over here. It just feels like you're watching part of the movie and you're looking in the background and the backdrops don't look properly rendered. There's crowd scenes and you're like, yeah, they've got 100 people here. And in the background, that's a repeat of the 100 people, maybe. But those people look very similar. Not like Lord of the Rings where you look and there's some really specific detail. Or something like Rise of the Planet of the Apes where they've articulated and made every single strand of hair look amazing. No, the fucking backdrop in this thing, they've got some trees here. And the rest looks not even like a painted matte backdrop. It just looks like unrendered mess. Wow. It looked kind of like The Sims in the background. Oh, wow. It was laughable. And you'd look in the background, you're like, hey, look at that, that's pretty funny. It's got flying scarab beetles. It's got, oh man, this movie's got so much stuff you've got to see.
You've got me curious.
But I think you got to maybe watch it in 3D because then you won't be looking so much at the background. Okay. Save that for a later treat.
Did you see it in 3D?
No, I saw it in 2D, so that's why I was able to appreciate the background, the unrendered background.
I kind of want to see that.
I want to see that.
But it is, it's like, I honestly didn't expect that I was going to
have fun.
Yeah, I didn't actually think I was going to enjoy it. I just went, I just want to see it.
So that's price, see, on the back of Exodus, Ridley Scott's Exodus, where he came under fire for bronze facing everybody, whitewashing the cast. Proyas has kind of got ahead of the curveball on this one, and about 2 or 3 months ago, he came forward and apologized ahead of time and said, "I'm really sorry for whitewashing the cast."
Well, I will respond and say that Alex Proyas is Egyptian.
Is he really?
He was born in Egypt.
Oh, there you go.
He came here when he was 3 years old.
Right.
So,
that doesn't mean he didn't whitewash the cast, though.
No, but I mean, like, this whole whitewash thing, like, whatever. It's a fantasy fucking film.
It is. And look, at the end of the
tell
day...
Tell me that there were flying fucking creatures and beetle bugs or whatever in Egypt.
Oh, I don't know. I wasn't there.
Exactly. Would you like to get...
But Glenn, after I watched this movie, I turned to Danny and I said, I know a dude that's going to love this movie. It's this guy.
Yeah, wow, really?
Glenn. This is a Glenn movie. Okay. I think he would get so much out of it, even more than I would.
Yeah. No, well, I'm really keen because, I don't want to see it, but I'm sold
it's,
on that.
It is a
that.
Real
yeah,
strange
It's better than a bad film that's fun.
This is going to be the best guilty pleasure of 2016. I reckon it's going to be on a lot of people's lists as a true guilty pleasure. I've seen a lot of reviews going out, and it seems like there's a lot of friends of Alex Proyas, not just on the IMDb, marketing people maybe at Fox and E1. But yeah, I've seen friends on my Facebook that I know are mutual friends, and they're putting out some pretty strong praise for this film in extraordinary ways. Like, I mean, you can enjoy it for what it is, and I think it's hugely enjoyable for what it is, but it's definitely not this, you know.
I wonder if it's going to be more of a guilty pleasure than Joe Dirt 2.
For you?
Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah.
I wonder.
Yeah, I don't know. No, yeah, I think this is a guilty pleasure that other people can enjoy.
All right, moving on.
Sorry, Sean. Sorry.
No, it's, you know. My guilty pleasure from 1993 is actually an HBO film.
Right.
Ew, hello. If anybody knows Sean Crawford, they know he loves Anthony Hickox. Not Anthony Hitchcock. Anthony Hickox for the next. He directed this little film with Mario Van Peebles called Full Eclipse.
Yeah.
Mario Van Peebles, Patsy Kensit, and the ever reliably horrid Bruce Payne. It's written by Richard Christian Matheson, who's been kind of kicking around the horror stomping yards for a little while. Most notably, recently he did Big Driver, the Stephen King adaptation. Oh, yeah. He's become pretty good friends with Stephen King, actually. But anyway, this film has Mario Van Peebles playing Detective Max Dyer, who LA cop gets involved with this elite branch of cops who go out on a limb and they push the boundaries of what the law can and can't do at nights, and they take down drug dealers and, you know, nefarious characters, maybe in illegal ways, maybe not in illegal ways. Does the ends justify the means? Until he realizes that they're all hyped up in this serum that turns them into werewolves.
Whoa, I have not seen this film.
Didn't see that coming.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
So then now he's involved in this squad. He doesn't know how to get in or get out or what's happening and this, that, and the other thing. It's really slick.
Right.
It's a really fun film. It's lunatic in its premise. It is so ridiculous that every time a full eclipse comes, every time a full moon comes, these six cops turn into werewolves and just tear up the streets. But Anthony Hickox is such a good action director.
He is.
Like, he really is, isn't he? Like, he's one of these guys. I've said it before, particularly Glenn, because he's a fan. Nobody moves a camera like Anthony Hickox. He's got such an incredible eye. He's one of those guys, you always felt like he had the capacity to move outside this sort of straight-to-video realm that he was in. He's been batting around for ages. He did Warlock, the Armageddon. He did Hellraiser 3. He did Waxwork and Waxwork 2. And then he sort of started diversifying and moving outside of horror and doing
Jill
all these
Rips and all that.
Jill Rips. He became like a bit kind of... Until eventually, in about 2005-ish, he made a film with Steven Seagal called Submerged. And after that, he just called it quits. And he stepped off for nearly 10 years.
Wow.
And somebody came back and when he made his next film, called Knife Edge, which was a throwback to the 70s thrillers that Britain used to produce. Somebody said to him, why such long time between drinks? And he said, Steven Seagal. Steven Seagal was the problem. He said, like, Steven Seagal would show up, say whatever lines he wanted, when he wanted, show up whatever days he wanted, didn't want to come in and do ADR, didn't want this. And I just stepped back and thought, I'm a better director than this, and then just called it quits for 10 years.
Wow.
But this Full Eclipse, along with Hellraiser 3 and Warlock Armageddon, they all came within 2 years of each other.
I was gonna say, yeah.
Yeah, they were really clumped together, and that was his sort of golden period for me.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, he that was when he hit the peak of his powers, and he's never quite got back there for whatever reason. But if you're into a really slick, ridiculous, lunatic action films with a slight horror slant, it is really worth your time. Gary Chang's score is great as
the
well.
The thing that always resonated with me with his films in that era was his use of digital effects. Like, I mean, you had people like James Cameron already pioneering new stuff, but for a B-movie sort of filmmaker, particularly in Warlock Armageddon, where you got scenes with things flying around, it looks artificial, but you can't quite pinpoint why it looks so appealing.
Yeah, I agree.
It's really nice about the way it moved.
He comes from Hollywood royalty. Like,
isn't his father a sir?
His father's a sir who was an actor in a lot of those Hammer films that he was homaging with Knife Edge. But his mum is an editor, like an Oscar winning editor. Anne Coates. She's been kicking around since forever.
Coates.
Yeah, that's his mum.
Holy shit. Yeah. I didn't realize
that. And he's he actually started life, I'm sure it's Anne Coates. I'm probably going to look stupid here, but I'm sure it's Anne Coates. If it's not, you can...
Rings a bell.
You could just cut that bit out if it's not. But, I mean, for a guy, he started off as a bouncer.
Yeah.
Like, that's how he got his gig in life. He started off as a bouncer, and now, like, yeah.
Yeah. So he re-emerged recently, a few years ago, with Prisoners of the Sun, which he produced with Pete Atkins.
Pete Atkins, who he's working with in Hellraiser 3.
Massively undervalued film. Really, really good.
Yeah, I never...
Better than the Mummy films.
That wouldn't be hard.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Anne Coates, that blows my mind. Yeah.
He's actually comes from a really strong lineage of film heritage. But he's if you haven't seen his films, he's really worthwhile. Not so much lately. Give it up from about 1995 onwards. But before that, he was a man.
How can you track this one down? Like,
Full Eclipse. It's
is it on DVD?
It was released. It was never released locally. You can get it. It was released in the UK and it was released in America for certain. And I'm sure if you go to the HBO website, you could probably track down a copy. I know you can get a copy on eBay.
Yeah.
And I know for a while you could watch it, stream it on YouTube. Whether it's still there or not, I don't know. But because obviously the DVD revolution and it was never a local release, that's the only way I've managed to be able to watch it. It's,
I want to see the shit out of this movie now.
Yeah, and Patsy Kensit is just as wooden as ever, but she manages to outshine Bruce Payne.
We are going to do a fake Shemp marathon, the three of us. Anthony Hickox, fucking Vindaloo, Pepsi next, and we're gonna fucking watch the shit out of that stuff.
And a couple
so,
beers.
So. Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's it. That's my guilty pleasure. Full Eclipse, 1993.
Someone's killed their children and made them into cookies, and I want to go see that.
That brings us to the end of another episode. Is there anything else you boys want to note? Anything worthy of mention before we throw the towel in?
No.
Any news?
It's just the end again.
Okay. We're not well. You did a great job helming this show, by the way.
Yeah, nice work, dude. I particularly like the intro for the Focus film. You handled that superbly.
Are you?
Consummate. Consummate.
I'm never coming back.
Come on,
here
give
again.
Us some news, dude. Tell us one bit of gossip from
the movie world. Let's see the trailer for the mashup between The Ring and The Grudge dropped.
Yes.
That looks interesting. The trailer gave me goosebumps. What do we feel? Is it a good idea? Is it a bad idea? Is it a quick cash grab-in?
Dumb idea, not interested.
It's a dumb idea, isn't it? Yes. I am interested just to see how much they fuck it up.
But we're going to have that, right? So that's coming out. And then we're also going to have the US Rings open in October. It got pushed from, I think it was scheduled for an April release, and the studios pushed it to October. So we're going to have another American Rings movie, and this is the Japanese mashup of the Grudge and Ring. Yep. Alright, it's really weird. Why are we going back to J-horror remakes of J-horror? It's happening in the early 2000s,
yeah,
right?
This is 10, 15 years
massive
old.
Massive backward step.
Yeah.
But horror at the moment is stale, and everything's fucking zombies. And
well, yeah, zombies, found footage, you know, these are generally the two things we're seeing played out.
But, and horror's always done the cycles. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, slashers come and go every sort of 10 years, something new.
But we
new
do need more slashers.
No, we do, because zombies is well and truly overstated, of course. Absolutely. And yet there's so much more zombie shit coming.
Absolutely.
I will add that Pride, Prejudice and Zombies is very good.
Yeah, so I really
it does
see
look
that.
Really
it
good.
It is good, it's fun, so.
Yeah.
But it, once again, it recognized that it is a stale genre and it gave us something really new.
Yeah.
So.
And on that note, maybe this could be considered film gossip. I did read that, you know, the screenwriters of Deadpool, they're the guys that helmed the original Zombieland.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Now they're, you know, talking about Zombieland 2. Apparently it's never left the table because the Amazon produced the Amazon. No, like the river.
Yeah.
Amazon. They produced an original series pilot for Zombieland, and you could vote, and it was shit. I watched it; it was awful.
I remember.
Luckily, I didn't proceed with doing it.
Yeah.
So there's now talking about this Zombieland 2, and I'm like, it's a great film. Just leave it be. Just leave it be because we don't need another zombie comedy. Yeah.
Exactly the type of film I mentioned in my Zoolander 2 review about sequels that don't need to exist because the originals sort of have such an oomph. On their own.
And too much time's passed now.
Yeah.
That you can't.
Yeah.
You can't compete with that.
Speaking of Deadpool, Deadpool has made roughly $1 trillion at the box office.
Yes.
Nobody saw it coming. What's this going to mean for Marvel and the R-rated, well, the American R-rated, the Australian MA-rated superhero movie? Glenn, I know you're not interested because you don't dig it.
What?
You don't like superhero movies?
I fucking love Deadpool with a passion.
Wow, but yeah, but what are the wider ramifications for the Marvel universe now that an MA-rated film, an R-rated film has come, made an exceptional amount of money? Then is this going to be a one-off?
I think the word there is exception. I think that Deadpool will continue an R-rated tradition, but I don't think the rest of them will.
I think Disney will stick with what's working for them. I think the other Fox properties that they've got in Marvel, they may start experimenting a bit more, particularly with the Wolverine-Deadpool crossover film, which is supposed to be, I think, Hugh Jackman's last. I think now there's talk that Todd McFarlane's written a Spawn screenplay.
Yep. Yeah.
I think that's definitely getting produced. And then the most interesting news is that Superman versus Batman, Dawn of Justice, whatever, they're going to release a harder cut version on Home End. So they'll still do the PG-13, but they'll do the US R version.
And
these
aren't the first R-rated comic book movies.
But these are the first ones to rake in. What did Deadpool get? $150 million? That is a lot of coin. Because what was the budget of Deadpool? 40? 45? It was something stupid like that. It was next to nothing.
Very interesting parallel, because then you've got Ant-Man, which is a PG Marvel film. And
exactly.
Deadpool, same universe they're occupying.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they're the two. They're my favorite two
of the
Marvel, you know, go adaptations thus far.
What about Rob Zombie?
A good lead goes a long way, you know, strong lead.
Yeah.
Talking about a tired genre, Rob Zombie's latest film, 31, finally got past the censors.
Yes,
this is like the third go to get it past. This is
to get it passed locally?
No, for American censors.
Right, okay.
This isn't the first time this has happened to Rob Zombie. His first
film. I think it's deliberate.
You think it's deliberate?
Oh,
for
fucking
Christmas?
I.
It is. It's a crowdfunded film, so it doesn't have the market and push capacity or capability behind it. That you think this is a marketing ploy?
Well, he's going to get an R just so he can get some advertising, put it in theaters, and then just release the unrated version on Home End, and everyone's happy.
It's become a trend with Rob Zombie to have trouble getting his films out.
Yeah.
But there's no shortage of popularity for them.
That's true.
You know?
But the reviews that I saw surface, because it played at, Sundance?
It was Sundance.
I think it was Sundance, and it was the midnight movie madness sort of screenings. And the reviews look pretty poor for it.
Which is going to be my next thing. Because if the reviews come out poor for this new one, that's three strikes for Rob Zombie.
Can he just quit and just fucking go back to making music? People seem to like his music a lot more than
his
movies.
I
know he's got his fan base.
I like his films.
I do.
I like one of them.
No, I like them all except for the Halloweens. I mean, I think, obviously the first two are fantastic. Like Devil's Rejects, House of Thousand Corpses. I think Lords of Salem is amazing.
I think Lords of Salem is really underrated.
Oh my god, Lords of Salem is intolerable.
I think it's incredible.
Incredibly.
I don't know. I don't know.
Hillbilly wanky bullshit.
I wouldn't go so far as to say it's incredible, but I certainly think it deserves.
Visually, it is.
I think it's really.
But where was everything else in that fucking film?
Well,
I thought it was a mess.
We're only talking to
visually,
Jarrett.
It looked quite good. It looked quite good, I'll give you that.
All right. Last but not least, Julianne Moore circling as the villain for the new
Kingsman.
I just don't care.
Really?
No.
Why not? You were a massive fan of the first one.
Yeah, I love the film, but I don't love Julianne Moore. I don't.
I think she's an extraordinary actress, but I would amazing. Like to see her play her a villain because she's been doing so many roles well, where she has been playing.
Last time she was a villain, The Seventh Son was appalling.
Seventh Son.
Yeah, you don't even remember it. It cost $100 million. Jeff Seventh Bridges was Son. In it. And it was that fantasy piece of shit.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That, yeah. I never watched it.
No, it was like awful.
Shit.
It
yeah.
was terrible.
Yeah.
But now she's circling to be the female evil villain in the new Kingsman film.
I'm sure she'll be great.
Colin Firth isn't going to be in it.
I'm excited. Well, you know, that makes sense.
Well, it makes sense. No spoilers for anybody.
But Matthew Vaughn coming back is incredible because obviously yes. he didn't return to do Kick-Ass 2, which I still think was an incredible sequel.
Yeah, I think it was really good.
But, yeah, great news. Matthew Vaughn's returning to do it.
Yeah.
The guy is an extraordinary filmmaker and, yeah, I'm excited, but we've got a long way ahead of us before we get some tasty.
I'm sure she'll be really good in the role. I'm sure the film would be great. I'm not excited about it.
Anything else?
Does that word offend you? Vaginal?
All right. So anyway, let's wrap this up. I think I've had enough. My throat is about exhausted.
Yeah.
Excellent.
So that's it for us. I just want to make a quick apology to Lynette Lawler for whatever we might have said that might have upset her and made her feel a little bit insignificant.
Sorry, Lynn.
And that's about it. So, groovy. Thank you for listening, everyone. We'll catch you next time.
And our focus film will be Austin Powers, apparently.
I can't tell if you're serious or not.
No, because he said groovy, and I'm like, what?
Glenn's head just about exploded.
No,
there.
It
could have been.
I'm like, short fuse. What?
There you go.
I don't know.
See
you. For some reason, it hadn't happened.
I don't even know where to cut that.
I know.
Nah.
See you next week, guys.
Yeah, just add that in the post.
Ciao.
When Ahasuerus heard the news of Haman's evil scheme, he told his wife Queen Esther, don't for Brent. Boom, 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 boom. Haman will be punished and the Jews will all be saved. And you'll Shepnachus later in my tent. Boom, 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 boom. Purim, 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 it's a time to have some fun by drowning out the sound of Haman's name. Purim, 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 spread the news to everyone that Mordecai and Esther saved the day. Ha 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 ha!